सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। ॐ वासुदेवेन्द्रयोगीन्द्रं नत्वा ज्ञानप्रदं गुरुं मुमुक्षूनां हितार्थाय तत्त्वबोधोऽभिधीयते। तत्त्वविवेकः कः? तत्त्वविवेकः कः? आत्मा सत्यम्, आत्मा सत्यम्, तदन्यत् सर्वम्, तदन्यत् सर्वम् मिथ्येति, मिथ्येति। Last week we looked at this curious phenomenon wherein I never seem to ask who I am, because I know who I am. The world is constantly filling in for me who I am. There's an unexplored territory of who I am. And it leaves a blank, it leaves a space, and that space is filled in by the world. Creation fills in that space for us through this sense of identity of what's around us. So if I were to walk down the street and I were to ask a man on the street saying, who are you? It may be a little bold, but I would ask him, start a conversation up, and I say, who are you? You know, what are you about? He would most likely tell me his occupation. He would say, I'm a carpenter. Who are you? Oh, I'm a carpenter. I'm a software engineer. Oh, I'm retired. I'm a hairdresser. I am the vice president of the United States. There's a very strong identity with what we do, which is very interesting because we will see later that I, as awareness, am not a doer. I am a karta. I am not a doer, but we identify so strongly with all these roles that we play. One of them is being an employee or an employer. What is our occupation? What do we occupy our time with? We may give our socioeconomic status. Oh, I'm just a poor man trying to eke out a living. Oh, people might not say this, but you could tell. They'll somehow present with their Rolls Royces and their multi-million dollar mansions that they are perhaps a different socioeconomic strata that I might be. Gender. We've identified very strongly with gender. I'm a man. I'm a woman. Racial identity. I'm African American. I'm white. I'm Asian. National identity. I'm American. I'm Russian. I'm Indian. Even sports. I'm a soccer fan. I'm a football fan. I don't like basketball, let's say. And then it's not only the sport, but the team. I always root for the Chargers because we're in San Diego. They're hardcore Oakland Raiders. You know, people tattoo their body with their sports team insignias. Politics. People have a very strong identity with politics. Who are you? Oh, I'm a Republican. Oh, I'm a Democrat. Oh, I'm a Libertarian. Oh, I'm an Independent. A Congress party. I don't know anything about Indian politics, but it's getting a lot of press lately. All these roles, all these identities, religion specifically. Oh, I'm a Christian. Oh, I'm a Hindu. I'm a Muslim. I'm a Buddhist. I'm an agnostic. I'm an atheist. So we have this identity, this strong identity with all these associations we have, which belong to this individual, to this body-mind-sense complex. There's a technical term, karya karana sanghata. It's going to come up again and again. Karya karana sanghata. Karya in this context means the body. Karana means the instruments. Literally, it means instruments. So it means the senses, and it means the antakarana. It means the inner instrument, the mind, and everything that comes along with that. This karya karana sanghata, sanghata means the collection, the assemblage. Karya karana sanghata is the body-mind-sense complex. Body-mind-sense complex. And through this Karya Karana Sanghata, we have association with all sorts of groups. We have a national identity, we have a team identity, we might have a music identity. I remember when I was a child, I had an identity regarding what my favorite color was. I felt lost. I realized I didn't have a favorite color. When I was in second grade, they were asking, what's your favorite color? And I thought, I don't have a favorite color. So I went and looked at all my crayons and decided that this was my favorite color. And it was some sort of blue. It wasn't turquoise. It was like a royal blue, I think, something like that. But my identity did not feel complete until I knew what my favorite color was. You hear of teenagers needing to go find themselves. They need to go backpacking through Europe to find themselves over the summer break. What does this really mean? It means for them to, you're forming your identity as a young adult during that time. So really, it doesn't really mean that they're going to look for Atma. They're not looking for the truth of themselves. They're looking for really what their values are, what their talents are, what their inclination is, where they see themselves going. You know, they're looking for their identity as an individual, regardless of how they want to proceed in life. This is not Atma Vichara. This is just a growing up process. And then some people have a midlife crisis. They have an identity crisis. They say, well, who am I? I spent all these years working. I'm 40 years old, and is this the life that I want? So they buy a sports car, quit their job, or leave their wife even because they have this identity crisis. Who am I? So we identify with all these roles, right? We identify with being a father, with being a son, with being, an employer or employee. And so, interestingly, many of these are mutually exclusive and they're impermanent, right? I am a father to my son and I'm a son to my father, but these are just roles that I inhabit, these roles that I play, like an actor. An actor can, a multi-millionaire can play a role of a beggar, a homeless person, and be very happy doing it because he knows in truth that he is just filling that role. I fill the role of a father. I fill the role of a son. I fill the role of an employee. And just as an actor knows that he himself is not defined by that role, so too, once we have this Atma Anatma Vichara clear, this Atma Anatma Viveka has been done, we find that we fill the roles that our prarabdha, our destiny, calls us to fill, but it doesn't define us, it doesn't limit us. We're not poor, even though we might be playing the role of a beggar. And yet that actor can fully fill out that role where he can be distraught and he can bring tears to his eyes, and yet he knows that he's much more than just that role. So where does the I land? Where does this first person singular I land? This ahankara, both this thought I and this commitment. We have a commitment to these identities that we have and to the very structure of our individuality, which is, for example, this body, which is, in essence, a hairy skin bag. It's a bag that keeps all this stuff from falling out, and it's filled with this structural mechanism and this skeletal system and neurological system and all these systems. And it's a wonder in and of itself. But the senses, backed by the mind, which seems to enjoy awareness, is the subject to the body, which is the object. The senses objectify the body. The only way I know the body is through the senses. So I know the body through all the five senses. And we talked last week about we have the sense of touch which permeates this entire body, and we have these superpowers where I can lift my hand without lifting my hand. And I don't know if you saw that TED talk that I sent out. I just fell on it a couple days after the class last week. I was listening to an NPR program that sort of summarizes TED Talks. And this was the first one that came up, and it was about that, I don't know if you saw the video, but about a woman who's working with these engineers and doctors to create these artificial limbs that you can directly manipulate just through thought and actually sense. Because they say that even someone who, say, in World War II got his arm cut off, the senses are still there. And so if you stimulate electronically certain nerve endings in his stump of his arm, he will feel that as if he were feeling things in his fingertips. And you still have the nerves that send the impulses to move your hands. So what they do is that they take these nerves, they're very, very subtle signals, and so they need to amplify these signals. And so they amplify them. It's called targeted innervation. What they do is that they take these nerve signals, these nerve endings from the stump of the arm, and they reroute them into the chest. And then when, after a few months after it heals, when the person thinks, move my hand, the chest muscles move. And they move such that they can put sensors on there. And then through robotics and through wireless technology, they can make that hand move in response to those chest muscle movements, which are responding directly to that person's thought, let me move my hand. And they can put sensors on the tips of these prosthetic devices and work them back into the nervous system such that they can actually feel things at the tips of their fingers. So this whole example I used about this robotic little finger was, I just made that up. I didn't know that they were actually doing such things, but the technology is still very, it's very primitive. They have a long way to go, but there's a lot of potential there. But really, that person who now has the ability to sense through their prosthetic limb and move their prosthetic limb with just their thought, is that them or not? We can develop a sense of identity with that prosthetic limb. We can cry when it goes, but that's not me. I can unscrew it, unhook it, and it'll just be there. So too with the body. Exact same relationship with the body. Just because I can move it, just because I can feel through it, doesn't mean that it's me by any sense. So this Dehatma Buddhi, this notion, this buddhi, this idea that I, Atma, is the Deha, this whole Karya Karana Sanghata, this whole body-mind-sense complex, is what we're trying to tease out. We're trying to figure out really what's the truth of this Dehatma Buddhi. And we're trying to disentangle I from not I, Atma from anatma. The sentence we're working with says, Atma Satyam, Tat Anyat Sarvam Mithya. So we're taking Atma and Anatma, or as the author says, Tat Anyat Sarvam, everything other than the self and everything other than the self, the Anatma, and we're trying to tease them apart as we did a red hot iron ball. Now we're so convinced that iron is red and hot, and we're so convinced that fire is round and heavy. When I take myself to be this Karya Karana Sanghata, when I take myself to be this body mind sense complex, I take this body to be awareful, and I take this body to be myself. I am the body, and the body is me. There's no difference between the two. I am awareful. And any consciousness, awareness that this body has through the senses to sense things is actually borrowed from me. Just like the red hot iron ball borrows its heat and borrows its brightness from fire. When in truth, iron is round and heavy and fire is red and hot. And yet all we know is this red hot iron ball. What do you mean this body is not conscious? Well, we see that I am the perceiver of this body. This body just enjoys consciousness because I lend it that consciousness. Consciousness is not awareness, is not an inherent attribute of this body. So too, we go on to the senses, like in today's meditation. We know the senses. We know whether my eyes are clear or foggy. We know whether I can hear or not. We know whether I can feel or if my nose is clogged up and I can't smell anything or taste anything. So too the prana, the energies in the body. And so too this vast internal environment that we have. All emotions, no matter how strong, no matter how much they try to take us away, I, as awareness, illumine. I am the Sakshi. I am the awarer. I am that awareful presence of all states of mind, the emotional mind, the rational mind, the desires, the raga, the dvesha, the aversions, the manas, the emotions, the buddhi, the rational mind, the clear thinking, the muddled thinking, the projections into the future, the remembrance of the past, our knowledge and our ignorance, my inner child, my inner parent, this whole dialogue that we have in ourselves, within our mind sometimes, between our child, the remnants of our questionable upbringing, the samskaras from just growing up as an individual, and the internalized voice of our parents telling us how good we are or how otherwise we are. All of that, our inner monologue, our inner dialogue, I illumine all of that. I, as consciousness, and this is why some of those meditations we've been doing are so important now, because I need to really see that thoughts come, thoughts exist, and thoughts go, and they don't displace me. They don't take me away from myself. I am there in every thought. I am the present, awareful being in every thought. And I am Shuddha. I am Nitya Shuddha. I am completely pure. I'm completely unsullied. I'm Asanga. Asangoham, Asangoham. I am not tinged in the least by any coloration of the mind. If the mind is Tamoguna Pradhana, if it's Tamas, if it's dull, if it's base, if it's rajasika, if it's agitated, if it's excited, if it's sattva, if it's very calm and quiet, the mind goes from one state to another. And I see, if I have the alertness, I can see those states come and go. I don't go when a certain thought goes. Like last week, I don't go when the tree thought goes and it's replaced by a thought of an elephant on the savannah, on the plains of Africa. Those thoughts are mutually exclusive. The roles that I play are mutually exclusive. Let's say I'm an Indian citizen and then I decide to become an American citizen. I'm still the same person. Those two roles of nationality are mutually exclusive, just like the thoughts of a tree and an elephant are mutually exclusive, but I am that one persistent, existent, conscious, awareful being that accommodates all of that, much like space. Gagana sadrisham, they say. Gagana means space. Gagana sadrisham means like space. Swamiji used to say, like Teflon. It's like Teflon. Nothing sticks to it. Nothing sticks to consciousness. If we have an experience that upsets us, that can stay around in our mind, and our mind can regurgitate it again and again and again. But that's a function of the mind. I illumine that regurgitation. I illumine that perseveration. Sometimes we have this internal perseveration wherein we can't get something out of our mind. We just keep going over and over and over and over. An innocuous version of this is what's called a thought worm. Have you ever heard of a thought worm? A thought worm is a song that you just can't get out of your head. It's usually some jingle. Some catchy jingle that maybe you heard when you were a little kid, or some tune that is just annoying, but there's something in there that, like a worm, just gets into your mind and you just can't get it out. And the mind goes on and on and on and on. But when our emotions are embedded in those thoughts because of our reaction to a situation, because it's different than what we want it to be, regardless how irritating it is, regardless how agitated, regardless how strong an emotion is, I am there fully illuminating that emotion. And it's sometimes so difficult to see because emotions and thoughts can be so strong. And we've always, this iron ball has always been red and hot. So it's so easy for us just to forget, to just get lost in this notion that the first person singular resolves into this karya karana sanghata. This first person singular pronoun I truly resolves into the Atma, about which we've just begun to scratch the surface. But by disentangling, we can begin to know that when I say I really mean this conscious being. And in Vyavaharika, in day-to-day life, we go on and we say, I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, I stubbed my toe. There's no reason to change our language when we know that the body and the mind and the senses are just incidental to us. They're not primarily who we are. We don't need to speak in a new spiritual, quote-unquote, spiritual vocabulary. But the practice of being alert to where the I lands, where this I notion, this ahankara, what it resolves into, every moment, it's always telling us who we are. Because we don't know who we are. This ahankara, we can have an ignorant ahankara or an enlightened ahankara. The ahankara is always going to be there, regardless of your ignorance or your wisdom. All aspects of the mind, more or less, are going to be there. I mean, you're going to have a manas, and we'll go into exactly what the manas and buddhi and chittam and all those things are, but you may have less reactivity, and you may have some dispassion, and you may have some alertness. You may have some shama, dhamma, ityadi. Those are all good things. But you're still going to have this thought saying, I'm hungry. I think I should go get something to eat. This eye is always going to be popping up. That's just part of the mind. Just like the sun is always going to set, but we don't need to freak out every time the sun sets because of our knowledge. We know what's happening there. And so I can use this I flexibly. I can use this I as is appropriate, this thought I, but I know that what is there is an awareful being, which that naturally resolves in. And once you've done some more shravanam, once you have a little shravanam under your belt, there can be a practice of always resolving that I thought into myself rather than the phenomenon around me, rather than this kardiya karana sanghata. Because I, as an awareful existent being, am fundamental. I, as a body mind sense complex, that I is just incidental. And so, if I don't know the truth of this true I, of who I am as a conscious existent being, then the world fills in that space, fills in that gap, and it tells me that at the core of my being, I may be a 5'2" Indian woman who loves soccer and is a doctor, or I may be a 7-foot-tall African-American basketball player who has liberal politics and enjoys ice cream, you know? All these things around us, all these roles, all these preferences we have become us unless we have this Atma Anatma Viveka. And this Atma Anatma Viveka is a cornerstone to this Tattva Viveka that we're doing right now, this discriminative analysis into the nature of reality. So we've looked at what is Atma and what is Anatma. What is Atma and what is Tat anyat sarvam, what is different, everything that's different than that. But then he makes a statement about each of those. He says, Atma satyam, Atma is reality, is true, is real. Tat anyat sarvam, the anatma, the not self, is mitya, iti. This is tattva viveka. I won't translate mitya. It takes a little bit of understanding. So let me tell you a story. It's story time. Sit back. I'm taking great liberties. I'm giving you the Hollywood version of an Upanishad story. And I take full responsibility for any colorful aspects of this story. But it's an ontological tale. It's a story so that we can begin to understand what we mean when we say Vedanta is an exploration of realities. Because there's realities of things, and then there's realities. The of things are the individual, the world, the Lord. And the realities are how we understand those things. So there was, as a Chandogya talked about, a rishi named Uddalaka, who had a son, Shvetaketu. And as was the practice at the time, when Shvetaketu was 12 years old, Uddalaka and Mrs. Rishi sent him off to boarding school. I warned you, this may be a bit colorful. He sent them off to Gurukulam to study, as they did in that time. And he came back 12 years later as a 24-year-old young man. Swamiji is fond of saying, with an earring. And he was basically full of himself because he was the best student. He came back with a PhD in the Vedas. He knew the Vedas. He knew all the Vedanga, the phonetics, the grammar, the rituals, the etymology, the prosody, the astrology. He knew all of that. And he's described in the Upanishad as being Mahamana, one who has a great mind. Maha means great, manas means mind, but it doesn't necessarily mean one who has a great mind, who's one who thinks very highly of himself because he's very well informed and intelligent. He was arrogant. And they call him, in the Upanishad, his father notices that he's stubdha. Stubdha means rigid. Literally means rigid. It means proud. Someone who's rigid does not bow. He's incapable of bowing to someone else's opinion or even bowing and touching the feet of those to his guru and to his parents and those to whom he should be respecting. So he stubbed her. And Uddalaka saw this. He saw, uh-oh. His son comes home and he says, "Hey, pops." And Uddalaka says, "Okay, what have I done here? What have you taught? What have you taught my son?" And Shvetaketu sits down and puts his feet up on the table. He sits down on the couch and turns the television set on. And it is a bit disconcerting to Uddalaka. And so he wants to know really what his son has learned. So he asks Shvetaketu to turn the TV off for a moment. And he asks if he learned yena ajñātam vijñātam bhavati. The whole sentence is yena ashrutam shrutam bhavati amatamatam avijñātam vijñātam. Did you learn that by which the unknown is known, the unheard is heard, the unthought is thought? Which really means, as the Munika says, it says, kasmin nu bhagavo vijñāte sarvam idam vijñātam bhavati. Shaunika asks Angiras in the Mundaka Upanishad, kasmin nu bhagavaha, bhagavaha, O Lord, kasmin vijñāte, what is it that when it is known, sarvam idam vijñātam bhavati, everything else as though becomes known? What is that one thing knowing which everything becomes known? This is the essence of what Uddalaka asked if Shvetaketu was taught. Did your teacher teach you this one thing, knowing which everything else is as well known? And Shvetaketu says, I don't think my teacher knew it because he taught me everything. I lived with him for 12 years. I babysat his children. I fed his cats and dogs when they went on vacation. He should have taught me that. I don't think he even knew this. And Uddalaka's thought, oh, okay. Okay, he didn't know this. So he sits down on the couch next to his son. And he says, I would like you to meet Mr. Tucham. This is the father talking to the son, Uddalaka talking to Shvetu. He says, Shvetu, I'd like you to meet my friend here, Mr. Tucham. And Shvetu looks at his father and kind of looks around and he doesn't see anybody. And the father goes on and says, he is a Vandya Putraha. He comes from a long line of Vandya Putrahas. A Vandya means a woman who's never had a son, who's never had a child. Putra means son. So a Vandya Putraha is someone who is a son of a woman who's never had any children. His father was a Vandya Putra. His grandfather was a Vandya Putra. And you know where he lives, Shvetu? He lives in Gandharva Nagara. Gandharva Nagara, he lives in the city in the clouds. And Shwetu is sort of looking at his father and then back at his mother and his father, and it's kind of looking at his mother saying, is dad okay? He seems to be a little off his rocker. And you know, Uddalika goes on, you know, Shwetu, you know what he does for a living? He makes square circles. He makes square circles, does he, dad? Yes, and you know what he makes them out of? He makes them out of Sheshavishana. Very exquisite Sheshavishana. What's Sheshavishana? Shesha means a rabbit. Vishana means a horn. The horns of a rabbit. And so he knows his father is wacko. He knows it. Maybe they should have taken him in to get some blood work done. Because Mr. Tucham, who lives in the clouds, is a son of a mother who's never had any children, spends his time making square circles out of the horns of a rabbit. And he says, Father, are you sure you're feeling okay? Mr. Tucham is adyanta abhava, completely non-existent. Adyanta abhava. Tucham means completely non-existent. What is non-existent? Vandhyaputraha is completely non-existent. Gandharva Nagara, a city in clouds, does not exist. The horns of a rabbit do not exist. A square circle does not exist. His friend does not exist. Completely non-existent. It's an unholy alliance between things, between the Shesha and the Vishana. There is no such thing as a horn of a rabbit. Uddalika goes on and describes what Mr. Tucham does for a living. He has a website, which is really surprising. I didn't know that they had websites back in the Upanishadic times, but where he teaches a philosophy, a science of anrutam. Anrutam. The science of anrutam. So he has a whole page dedicated to how water boils at 20 degrees Celsius. Oh, Shwetu says, he does he, Dad? And he has a whole nother page dedicated to anrutam mathematics, where he proves that 2 plus 2 equals 5. Oh, does he, Father? Anrita is false. This is an ontological tale. Mr. Tucham is non-existent. Anritam is false. These are ontological words we have to help us describe our understanding of the reality of things. Tucham, completely non-existent. Anritam means false. So Shwetu says, Father, where are you going with this? And Uddalika says, okay, Shwetu, bring me that pot. So the son goes and brings the pot. Son, does this pot exist or not? And Shwetu looks at it and says, yes, it exists. Why does it exist? How do you know it exists? Because I see it. Ah, he says, it's pramana janya. It is born of a valid means of knowledge. The sight, I see the pot. It is pramana, a means of knowledge, janya. It's born, produced from a valid means of knowledge. It's pramana pratyaya vishaya. It's an object of the cognition gained through a valid means of knowledge. Shwetu says, yes, it is real. Therefore, it's satyam. Okay, it's satyam. It's true. It's real. Uddalika gets up and he goes outside and he pours the water out of the pot. Now, Mrs. Rishi rolls her eyes because she knows that she's going to have to go back to the well and fill that water, that guttam, that pot back up. And so Uddalika sits back down and he starts playing. A guttam is a classical Carnatic instrument. There's murdangam, there's ghatam, there's kanjira, which is like a tamarind, there's mursing, which is that jaw harp. And the ghatam is a beautiful, it's an amazing instrument. And it's a clay pot. It's usually embedded with some metal filings to give a little better ring out of it. But back in the day, it was just a clay pot, a ghatta, a simple clay pot. So he starts playing it. Ta di tum na, ta di tum na, ta di tum na. And he's doing much better than that, of course. And so he plays and plays and plays in aditalam. And at the very end, what the guttum players would do would be to throw the pot up in the air and time it such that it would go up into the air and land on the final beat of the song, on the final beat of the composition. It would come down and just shatter, and that would be the crescendo. That would be the climax of the piece. And he did that. He threw it up, and it fell on the ground, and it shattered. And Mrs. Udalika, Mrs. Rishi, came up and whacked him upside the head because she needed that pot. Now what is she going? She has to go back to the store and get another pot. She's not very happy. Be that as it may, once they settle down and their heartbeat comes back down to a normal rate, Udalika looks at Shwetu and says, "Please bring me the pot." And Shwetu says, "Father, I can't bring you the pot." He says, "Please bring me the pot." "Father, I thought you had gained some of your senses back. You're apparently just as crazy as you were a half an hour ago." Udalika says, "Bring me the clay." And Shwetu says, "Oh, I can do that. I'll bring you the clay." And he started picking up the clay and started giving it to his father. So Shwetu was asking his father, "Why did you ask me to give you the pot? The pot isn't there." And Udalika says, "But you said it was true. You said it was satyam. You said the pot was satyam. What happened to that satyam pot, that true, real, existent pot? Something that's true is trikalepi tishtati. Trikale api tishtati. Satyam is tishtati. It exists. Trikale api, even in trikala, even trikale, in all three periods of time. What is true, what is satyam, one definition, is that it exists in all three periods of time, in the past, in the present, and the future. So how can you say that that pot is real? And do we have two things there? Do we have a pot, and do we have clay? Why is it that when I said bring the pot, you brought that pot, but now you can't find it? What happened to it? That pot had a prior non-existence. It seems to have a present existence, and then it had a posterior non-existence. The pot is useful. The pot can carry water. The pot can be used as a musical instrument. But the pot, is it satyam or not? Look at the clay. What was there before the pot was there? Before the pot was there, the clay was there. While the pot was there, the clay was there. After the pot had been shattered, what was there? The clay. What is satyam? Satyam is the clay. Satyam is the clay. Udalika says, "Mritika iti eva satyam." Mritika, the clay, is satyam in relation to the pot. So what ontological status does the pot have? Is the pot tucham? Is the pot like Mr. Udalika's, Rishi's friend who's completely non-existent? Is the pot non-existent? No. We deal in a world filled with pots. They're very useful. It's not unreal. When people say this world is an illusion, this world is not an illusion. This world has the ontological status of being mithya. Tat anyat sarva mithya, everything other than the Atma is mithya. And what does that mean? It means that it has no independent existence of its own. The pot has no independent existence away from the clay. This is still Udalika. I'm putting a few words into Udalika's mouth here, to say the least. He says, "When you brought me that pot, what did you bring?" "Oh, Father, I brought you the pot." "No, son, you didn't. You brought me clay that at that time had the name and form of a pot. Before that pot was a pot, there was clay. While that pot is a pot, there's clay. And after that pot goes, there's just clay. So what's the truth of the pot even now? It's just clay. When I touch a pot, I touch clay. When I touch that pot, I touch clay. The pot has the texture of the clay. The pot has the color of the clay. All that is there is clay plus the form of pot, which is very useful to transact business in, to carry water and to play music, but it is mithya. It has no existence apart from the clay. Udalaka asks his son, okay, bring that plate, bring that cup, and bring another pot. Now, Mrs. Rishi is losing her temper because she knows that she's going to have to go to IKEA and buy a whole new set of dinnerware if her husband keeps instructing their son into the realities of things. And Udalaka says, don't worry, don't worry. Well, we'll get you another pot. It'll be fine. I won't break these. When you brought that cup, when you brought that plate, when you brought that pot, what did you bring? So now Shweta Ketu is catching on. He says, my father, I just brought clay. Touch each of those now. What are you touching? Touch the cup. Touch the pot. Touch this shard. What are you touching? I'm touching clay. When I touch the pot, I'm touching clay. When I touch the plate, I'm touching clay. When I'm touching clay, I'm not necessarily touching a pot or a cup or a plate. I'm touching the substance, which happens to be in a particular form at a specific time. What Udalaka actually says to Shweta Ketu is, Yata saumya ekena mritpindena sarvam mrinmayam vignatam syat mritika iti eva satyam. I left a part of that out because we'll get to that second part later, but he says, Yata saumya, oh dear son saumya, he wasn't mad at his son being so arrogant. He had compassion and he wanted him to see this. He says, Yata, just as ekena mritpindena, by a single, ekena mritpinda, by a single lump of clay, mrit is clay, pinda means a lump, yata, just as by a ekena mritpindena, by a single lump of clay, sarvam mrinmayam, everything, sarvam, which is made of clay, mrinmayam, vignatam syat, is known. By knowing the clay, you know as well everything that's made of clay. Mritika iti eva satyam. Mritika itself is satyam, is true. So by knowing the clay, Shweta Ketu understood that he knows the truth of the cup. He knows the truth of the plate. He knows the truth of all earthenware. So what about the functional but asatyam, the functional pot? It enjoys the status of being mithya, meaning that it has no independent reality. It has no independent existence. It has no existence on its own. It's completely dependent on its adhishtana, on its substratum, on its basis. It's only a name and form. Udalaka said, Vacha Rambadham Vikaru Namadeyam. It's just a modification of clay, which is Namadeyam, which is name, which is only a name, which is centered on the tongue. It's a convenience. We have many names for earthenware. We have pot, we have plate, we have cup. And so we believe there are many things. There's only clay with a particular form, a particular functionality, and a particular name. There's only clay there. And yet we can't dismiss the fact that we eat off of plates and we drink from cups and we play music on ghatta, on pots. They have served different functions, but it's a single clay. So the single clay, by knowing the single clay, you know the truth of all things made of clay. And the differences, the modifications, the vikaraha, are namadeya, our only name, vacharamanam, dependent on speech itself. Meaning, it's a notional thing. It's a notional reality. It's not an illusion, but it's not satyam, because they come and go. These names and forms come and go. It's not truth. It's not reality. It's not satyam, but it's not illusion. It's mithya. We have the special term, tat anyat sarvam. Everything else other than atma is mithya, has a dependent reality. Swamiji sometimes talks about this as being word and meaning, that there's a concept, there's a word. We have a word for a pot, and it has a meaning. What I've been talking about is functionality. It's a functional, convenient form, and we have a name for it. But the form comes and goes. And in my vision, I can resolve that pot into just being clay. I can resolve that cup into clay. I can resolve that plate into clay. Now, it's important to note that A is B, but B is not A. A is B, but B is not A. This is some of the crazy Vedanta mathematics. The pot is clay, but clay is not the pot. The plate is clay, but clay is not the plate. The cup is clay, but clay is not the cup. Does the pot hide clay? Does the pot cover clay? The pot does not cover clay. Mithya does not cover satyam. Mithya does not cover satyam. This world does not cover reality. Wherever there is mithya, a dependent reality, there, by definition, is satyam. Wherever there is a plate, there is going to be clay in a clay world. The pot doesn't cover the clay. The plate doesn't cover the clay. The cup doesn't cover the clay. Wherever there's a pot, there is clay. And the clay is not the pot, but the pot is never separate from the clay. And he says here that atma satyam, just like the clay is satyam in a world of pots and plates and cups, and the potness and the plateness and the cupness are incidental to the clay, are not intrinsic in the clay, do not limit the clay. The clay is free from being a pot, a cup, or a plate. So too, the Atma, the self, me, the object of the first person singular personal pronoun, me, I am that satyam, and tat anyat sarvam, everything else enjoys the status of being mithya. Everything other than the Atma, and we've seen that the Atma is a conscious, existent being, that consciousness is the truth of all anatma. All of this which we've said, neti, 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 neti. It's like the 10th man, that wayfarer comes up and says, okay, now line all your boys up, stand in front, okay, count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. What's my relationship with this body? I am not this body, but this body's existence is not independent of me. Just like pot is not independent of the clay. I am not this mind. The clay is not the cup. The cup is no different than the clay. The cup enjoys no independent reality apart from the clay. When I touch the cup, I'm touching clay. My thoughts enjoy no independent reality apart from existent consciousness, which I am. Thoughts do not cover the self. I am not hidden when a thought is there. Clay is not hidden when a pot is there. I am not hidden by the thoughts. My thoughts come, my thoughts stay, my thoughts go. The pot comes, the pot stays, the pot goes. Clay is always there and unaffected. Consciousness lends its existence to all anatma. This is going to take some unfolding. But what he's saying is that by saying that atma is satyam, that I am the clay, and everything else that is pot, plate, or cup is mithya, what he's saying is that the entire jagat, the entire anatma, the entirety of anatma, the entire karya karana sanghata, the entire body mind sense complex, its reality is me. That the reality that the body mind sense complex seems to enjoy is not separate from me. The body mind sense complex enjoys no independent reality other than me. And in fact, anatma is not just the karya karana sanghata. The not me is not just this body mind sense complex. The not me is this entire jagat. We started last week saying, I walk through a world of not me, of anatma. And then through some viveka, through some discriminative inquiry, we started to see that this body belongs in this world as much as any other object. And that these senses and these pranas and this mind belong in the subtle world, meaning that in my knowledge, I can relegate them as objects that exist within this physical or subtle world. That is all anatma. It is not me. But you say, this iron ball has always been hot and red. And those pots and cups and plates have always been real. So this is the magic of the Vedas. This is the wonder. This is the magic. This is why, as the Gita says, what is night to most people is daylight to the wise one. Because what a wise one sees when he looks at a pot and a cup and a plate, he just sees clay. When a wise man looks at the entirety of creation, he sees nothing but his own existent awareness. This is what this statement, which will be unfolded in much greater detail going forward, but this is what the statement, Atma Satyam Tad Anyat Sarvam Mithya means. It means that in the vision of the rishis, in the Arshadrishti, in a jnani's vision, or a wise man's vision, when he looks at you, he sees nobody different than himself. And when he looks at the entirety of the creation, the moon and the stars and the sun, he sees nothing but himself. Because in reality, all anatma is dependent on atma. Because all anatma is mithya. All anatma enjoys a dependent reality. And that dependent reality comes from satyam. Better way to say it is, what is the adhishtana? What is the basis of that dependent reality? What is that which the mithya is dependent upon? What is that that the pot is dependent upon for its reality? It's dependent on clay. What is that that this world, which is mithya, everything that we perceive, what is it that it's dependent on? It's dependent on atma. It's dependent on me. And we'll see this again and again, and we'll see this in ever-deepening ways as we progress through this text. There's a lot to say about this. To understand satyam and mithya is to understand Vedanta. We'll see more next week. Let's take a minute. Om swasti prajavyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishaha go brahmane vyashubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyaha prithivi sasya shalini desho yancho barahitaha brahmana santu nirbhayaha om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha sarve santu niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kashchit Dukkha Bhag Bhavet Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityor Ma Amritangamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om Om Tat Sat Sarvamishwar Arpanamastu.
Daksha ji, I had one question. So talking about the omnipresence of the clay and the various phases that clay can take, pot being one form, which can come and go, right? I mean, at the end of the day, there is like the truth, which is always present. And then there are various forms which comes and goes, which has its own purpose and it has its own merits. And but just to toggle it around, like, what is the point in having a fantastic gold bar if you don't make a jewelry out of it? Or like or you have like wind power and like nobody uses wind power, or like, yeah, so wind power is always there. Let's assume that is satyam, right? So the commercial world or the Western world is always wants applications on top of a theory. So even if you understand that, yeah, the theory is omnipresent and the everything else is like manifesting in different forms. I was just thinking, like, there are, yeah, we don't have to go to that theoretical model all the time. We can be aware of it, give credit to it, but we can also live the life. I mean, the thing is, like, we shouldn't forget that, right? That's the main thing, that we shouldn't forget the source from where truth comes from. Is that something that makes sense? Or I'm just thinking, like, yeah.
Yeah, I get the gist of what you're saying. Now, this knowledge is utterly useless except to solve the fundamental problem of life. The fundamental problem is that we take ourselves to be a limited being and we search for fullness in all the wrong places. We don't realize that I am everything that I really am searching for, and I already am what it is I want to become. So this is not a theoretical knowledge. This is an immediate knowledge because I am available for immediate recognition. So the fact that I am not limited by the body-mind-sense complex can be immediately appreciated. The fact that the truth of all of this is me can be directly seen. Now, when you see this all as nothing but yourself, you can choose to make bangles out of gold bars all you like. But you're not compelled to do that because there's nothing that you can accomplish that's any greater than recognizing that you are the truth of everything that is. So it's not a theoretical third-person knowledge. It's not something which one needs to acknowledge and then go on with their life pursuing the things that they need to pursue. It's that all pursuits resolve in this knowledge. But once that seeking, once that seeker resolves into this sought, into this knowledge of my own Purnatvam, there's nothing to stop one from doing whatever one is called to do. So you don't need to not do anything once you see this, but you're not compelled to be productive. There's nothing stopping you from accomplishing things in the world, but the reason you would accomplish something in the world with this knowledge is much different than if you didn't have this knowledge. Because if you didn't have this knowledge, and what do I mean by have this knowledge? I mean it's seeing very clearly. It's not a theory that Atma Satyam Tad Anyat Sarvam Mithya. It's not a theory that I am Satyam, that I am that one unchanging truth upon which this entire creation rests. It's not theory, but it takes some time to understand clearly, and it takes some time to gain an abiding knowledge of that. So does that begin to answer?
Right. But that is clarifying what I was asking. And the theory part, I just threw it as if just for a comparison purpose, not that what we're talking about is just a theory. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, you're right. Like, I mean, once we realize that, the self is the truth, and then we can continue doing our normal life, and like it'll take a different purpose, right? We don't have to slog out 24 hours a day trying to get $1 million, which is not the life right. that people otherwise think that's what they should achieve in life, right? Yeah.
Right. The urgency is not there. You look at people who have $1 million and they want two. And you look at people who have two and they want 5 million. And you look at people who have 10 million and they end up committing suicide. I mean, sorry, I don't mean to laugh, but we have these models that through changing our socioeconomic national identification, through changing any circumstance, will glom onto, will identify one point of identification and we'll want to change it because we think once we now move from being a 49ers fan to a San Diego Chargers fan, we'll be happy. But that urgency is not there. It's not the same urgency. But there's nothing to stop you from doing what it is that you need to do, from taking care of your family and earning some money. It's just life becomes a lot simpler. It's not nearly as complex. Because things are much simpler when you see that my Purnatvam is not dependent on any new experience, any acquisition, or any event.
Yeah, great.
Makes sense?
Makes sense, yeah. In fact, I was making a joke on this, Dakshaji, to a friend, like, if you win a couple of $1 million, or I don't know how much that... crazy jackpot thing that comes up once in like a few months and everybody gets crazy about it, like $65 million, something like that.
Oh, well, yeah, a lot more than that. Yeah, this Powerball, I think, is what it is, right?
Yeah, Powerball.
Yeah.
How much is it? Like 10 million or something like that? I don't know, maybe more.
I think it's hundreds of millions.
Okay, yeah, something like that, right? Like, so everybody gets excited and everybody talks about it, right? The thing is, like, if you win that type of lottery, I think your life will be totally messed up because all your friends and relatives and neighbors in the neighborhood will be coming and saying, hey, you're my best friend now, and like, let's go for like coffee or whatever, right? Like, so all the phones that you never got for like decades will be ringing now. So,
yeah.
And that somebody will mug you on the road if you walk and you become a popular guy. So, you'll actually become a more scary person there, actually.
So many things can happen. You hear some stories and people all of a sudden, like you said, you start getting very scared because you are now the centerpiece of so many people's attention who want something from you. And then you do these studies where you reach a certain stasis. So there's always a happiness set point that people seem to come back to. So whenever they've talked to people who've won millions of dollars in these lotteries, it always sounds like it's not true, but they've done studies. And so it must be true. I read it on the internet. But they've done studies where they come back to their same happiness set point and say, I'm no happier than I was before, because you still have all those same problems. You still have all those same limited notions that you have. Like, okay, so now you have money, but you still now have all these unwanted things that you need to get rid of, and you still have all these other things that money can't buy. And who's going to be attracted to you now that you're a multimillionaire? It may not be the best company that you would want to keep. I mean, look at Justin Bieber. So.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you all for coming.
Namaste.
Thank you.
Om Tat Sat.
See you next week. Thank you.